Well, joining us this morning on the line for the Asri Report, Ibrahim Fakir. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And jazakallah again, Murana, for having me.
Well, we can't seem to escape discussions about COVID-19, can we? And this time it's from a political and governance perspective, and with along with it, the other great pandemic, and that is corruption. Now, if we backtrack a bit, Ibrahim, the president's spokesperson's husband was awarded a massive tender for PPEs, and there were much ahs when this came to the fore. He claimed the contract was supposedly cancelled. There were allegations that he was paid through a series of fronts. The spokesperson, Kusela, then recused herself from work. She's now on special leave. And it turns out that the president's spokesperson's husband was on a series of boards. He was like everywhere. Then subsequently, it also comes to the fore that other leaders of the ANC and their connections also benefited from tenders and the procurement of PPE. And it was happening in other areas as well. Now, apart from the unethical aspect of it, it also raises so many questions about politics, about policy, about ethics. The ANC, I think we could safely say, is on the back foot. Ramaphosa is on the back foot when it comes to all of these reports now coming to the fore in terms of corruption relating to COVID-19. And we saw this week that two policy interventions were made. The first is that emergency procurement for COVID-19 was suspended. And the second is that a ministerial committee will be now conducting an investigation. My first question this morning, Ibrahim, is that are there political and policy interventions that are possible to rehabilitate our politics?
Gosh, Molana, I think, you know, people will try. And like you point out, there were two interventions made this week. The one is the cancellation of emergency procurement, and the other was setting up this interministerial team, investigative team, so to speak, right? Now, let's take the first one, which is the cancellation of all emergency procurement of PPE by the Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni. So, remember when the pandemic started, and under disaster regulations or certain emergency regulations which governments have powers to declare under the Constitution, because, you know, there are unforeseen circumstances and so on which have to be catered to. So, fine, fair enough. We accept that happens. Clearly, it is being abused. Hmm. Why was it abused? Because when you have emergency procurement, the normal rules for transparency, not that they work at the best of times, let's just put that up front. Even when there are transparency provisions for procurement, they don't always work. So under emergency conditions, it's even worse because it's, you know, it's an emergency. You've got a fund. Some people call it a slush fund. You can do with it what you want because ostensibly you are bypassing the normal longer routes to procurement and buying things because you're trying to address a serious emergency problem. So, you know, he says, okay, that is suspended. All contracts for PPE must now be made public. It must be published, number one. Number two, who was awarded that contract must also be made public. The scoring, that is, how did they end up winning this contract, must also be made public, as must the competitors and their scores. So everyone will now have access or can see, okay, Ibrahim tendered for this contract, Molana Rawat tendered for this contract, someone else also tendered this contract, and then who gets which score. So it will now become public. But the question here is, even when there were open tenders, which were transparent, where you could see who won, you never really had much joy because this problem has been dating back from the inception of democracy. Hmm. So, you know, first question you say, is there a chance to rehabilitate? Yes, there's a chance to rehabilitate. Yeah, you've got one set of options. They haven't worked under normal circumstances. The question here for me is that all regulation, any kind of transparency or disclosure regime or any regulatory architecture in governance can only work to a certain point. There's a point at which, Maulana, your honesty, your ethics, your morality has to kick in. Because you know what? Every time you create a rule, you can find a way of bypassing that rule. Every time you plug a loophole, you open up a small loophole somewhere else. That is just the way law and regulation and disclosure and transparency work, which is why you have basic values such as truth, such as honesty, you know, things that fall within the realm of morality. And there's a point at which that morality has to kick in. The second, you say this, you know, there's the establishment of this interministerial task team. Think back to Nkandla. Do you remember Nkandla?
Mm.
When the former president's house was built? You know, there were four simultaneous investigations going on. Four. The SIU, that is the Special Investigative Unit. The Public Protector, she was also doing an investigation at the time. Remember Tulima Ronsela? Then you had a ad hoc committee in Parliament, which was also conducting an investigation. And the government department in the executive, the Public Works, who was responsible for building this, was also conducting an investigation. And they found, remember, that there was price inflation, that people put up prices unusually, and so on. There were four investigations. Eventually, none of those investigations bore much fruit. The issue had to go to court.
Yeah,
it had to go to court. And when you have that many investigations on the same thing, there's so much obfuscation. There's so much place for hiding things. There's so much place for hiding behind legalities and saying, I'm not going to disclose this because I'll be incriminating myself. I'll only do so before a court of law. So there's still so much scope for obfuscation, for confusion, for duplication, for wasting time, and so on. But, you know, the government put itself, or the governing party as well, put itself in this position. So, you know, there are a few other options. Some people would say this is just optics, and to me it would seem like. But the deeper question, even if you want to accept the bona fides that this might in fact work, is that, you know, I think the moment you've got policies the way we have, such as the coincidence of three things: A, black economic empowerment; B, procurement on issues in which governments should not actually be procuring. They should do this themselves. These things should not be going out through tender. For example, you know, buying pens, I'm being silly, or toilet rolls, or stationery, or chairs, or furniture, or those kind of things. Why is there contracting or subcontracting for these kind of things? These are core business issues that the state or government must do itself. You go and buy it in the open market at a normal price. If you look at the way in which this price inflation has happened, it is scary. I mean, things which can cost you ordinarily 10 rand, you're paying 100 rand for per item. And, you know, there are all kinds of costs which are compounded on: administrative fee, management fee, storage, transport, warehousing, logistics, contingency fee, this, that. And all of that goes somewhere. Now, you can't have it both ways. If you want PEE, you have to accept that this kind of thing will eventually happen, because the incentives built in for creating what they call this middle class, or this layer, or this creation of black entrepreneurs and black empowerment, must allow you the space to do that, because that's the whole point of it, right? You want to quickly and rapidly create this class. You're not addressing massive social problems. In fact, you're delaying the addressing of many of the social problems. So, unfortunately, I think no matter what interventions you put in, if you don't reconfigure the real policy problems, you don't address the ethical and moral problems, you don't address the fact that the state should not be outsourcing or subcontracting some of its core functions, you will always be sitting with this problem.
Now, this suspension of emergency procurement, what are the implications, Brian?
But like I'm saying, firstly, it means that now everything has to be made transparent. Everything has to be published. You can see who tendered for this, at what price, and on what basis was the contract awarded. Now, I think what you will end up finding is you will find that there will be people who may have been cheaper, but they may not have met the BEE scores. So the more expensive one may have got it. You will now be able to, if you have the time and the inclination, as many investigative journalists have done, be able to trace what's the networks, what's the relationships. And there's a point at which, you know, the idea that someone who is related to someone in government, in authority, in power, in politics, or even on the tender committee, that they will never do business with the government, I mean, it's unrealistic, because there are two problems. The first, and I think here I have some sympathy for the view of the ANC. Remember, there have been pressure to say all people who are related must not ever do business with government. But they also got to make a livelihood. They also got to earn a living. You can't be so anti liberty, anti the opportunity of people to be able to engage in a living, that you bar them by accident of the fact that one of their relatives is in power or authority or in the state, that you bar them and you preclude them from being able to engage in earning a livelihood. So I think that's a bit too extreme. But you do need rules. For example, you need rules around revolving door syndromes. For example, you know, you go into government, you become a senior government official or a politician, you set up a regulatory framework, you suddenly leave government and you go out and do business in that very area. Now, those kind of things are just brazen. You think back to the Mbeki era, that kind of thing happened large scale. People working in IT, in telecoms, in hospitality, everywhere. You serve in government, you set up the regulatory infrastructure, you got insider information. In business, they call it insider information. You now know what's going to happen in the future. So you set up, meanwhile, you and your associates, you set up businesses in those areas to capitalize on the new regime which will be put in place. There may be subsidies, there may be benefits, there may be tax breaks, there may be all those kind of things. So those arbitrage, that helps you to do even better in business. So that's the first thing, the revolving door syndrome. Secondly, there has to be rules about when to declare conflicts of interest and so on. Now, we've got all that regulatory infrastructure is in place, and yet it is not working because there's a degree at which your ethics or your declaration is not transparent and people get away with it. Or you're so deeply connected that you will not be disciplined, that, you know, the favoritism, one rule for us, another rule for everyone else. So when those kind of things are prevalent, irrespective of what rules are in place, whether you change the emergency procurement rules or you don't, whether you publish, you don't, whether there's more disclosure, you don't, or not, this is the kind of thing that will happen. So there are implications, yes. It helps to make it more transparent and for disclosure, but you'd still be able to get away with many things, especially when levels of impunity are so high. The question here is, sure, you put in this suspension of emergency regulations. Things are now possible because they are published in this disclosure. You can see. But if you've hidden around here, if you can justify why you've made certain corrupt decisions, or more importantly, it is brazenly transparent that this is fundamentally corrupt or unethical or even against the rules. But if people don't take action against impunity, if there is no culture of consequence and accountability as there has been over all this period, it means nothing.
Finally, then, can this ministerial investigatory committee go some way into reversing issues, and will it create some credibility for the ANC to recover politically?
It can. It has the potential to do so. But there are going to be two problems. A, the investigations will take some time, because it's here you've got, you know, the ministerial committee, which Mr. Lamola, the Minister of Justice, says has teeth. Now, it can have teeth, but you can't have a ministerial committee being a prosecutor as well, right? So it's obviously going to be something which is conducting investigations, which is going to peruse all these things, which is going to make discoveries and uncover things. and then it will have to refer. It can speed up processes of referral to the NPA, to the SIU, to the Hawks, to everyone else, and then say, right, let this case proceed. But as we know, look, this Honto Commission, which is not even a normal legal process, it's taking so long. Can you imagine how long this will take? So I'm afraid the question for me about credibility, you know, of course the ANC is going to try and use this to show up legitimacy, the ANC in government. All the while, it seems it's just going to be a lot of smoke and mirrors, because all the while the credibility is going to continuously erode. And it seems that, you know, with all of these problems, all of these monumental problems going on for years through every different administration, very little actually of consequence happens. There's been plans, there's been investigations, there's been interministerial committees, there's been this intervention, that intervention, every other intervention, a new investigation, a new commission of inquiry, and very little of consequence has actually emerged from it. So, you know, I think, yeah, they will be making these interventions to show up legitimacy all the while. Credibility will continue to erode. So, unfortunately, you know, yes, it's the right decision to make. It's a little too late, I think. There's just so much damage in terms of its credibility, in terms of its ethics, in terms of public perceptions. And remember, this trust has been eroding over years now. So in two decades, I think this is the lowest ebb at which public confidence and public trust in institutions of government and the governing party are as low as they are. And they show in the election results, they show in the way in which people turn out to vote. And you're now hearing, and not that we can do much research, but we still try, you will hear people talking and saying, look, the only thing going now is that there is very little alternative. That's the only thing the ANC has got going for it. Putting out positive things that it has done has reached its sell-by date, because people are tired of, well, we've got a great welfare state, things more or less work, we are not a completely failed state. Those things can no more be put out. The rapid delivery of basic services, housing, which has really been done relatively well. But when you can't grow the economy, jobs are the way they are, you've got such high levels of corruption, levels of ethics are low, and so on. You can't rely on that anymore. First 25 years of delivery doesn't cut it anymore. You've got to continue doing it. If you can't expand that base, if there's so much corruption, all of that doesn't work. So I'm afraid this now looks like, try as hard as you might, the credibility dent is just far too large.
Yeah. Brahim, as always, shukran so much for your time, for the insight and for the analysis. We really appreciate it.
Shukran. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was Ibrahim Fakir with this week's Asrari.